Part 1. Spiritual Preparation. Chapter 1. What to do for yourself before you die. Even if you are going to die tomorrow, you train tonight. Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche. For someone who has prepared and practiced, death comes not as a defeat, but as a triumph, the crowning and most glorious moment of life. Sogyal Rinpoche. Living a good life, learning to let go. The most important spiritual preparation for death is to lead a genuinely spiritual life. We will die much the same way that we live. As the poet Kabir said of death, "What is found then is found now." A good life generates good karma that will then run its natural course, leading to a good death. The maxim, "Karma will take care of you," applies most directly to death. But there's a difference between "I'll take care of it" coming from Mother Teresa or from the Mafia. Good karma will take good care of us when we die. Bad karma will take bad care of us. The Dalai Lama says, "In day-to-day life, if you lead a good life, honestly, with love, with compassion, with less selfishness, then automatically it will lead to nirvana." We must implement these good teachings in daily life. Whether you believe in God or not does not matter so much. Whether you believe in Buddha or not does not matter so much. As a Buddhist, whether you believe in reincarnation or not does not matter so much. You must lead a good life. In my simple religion, love is the key. Karma is basically habit. It's the momentum of repeated actions that become habitual. It's in our best interest to develop as many positive habits as we can. In the Mahanama Sutta, the Buddha said, "Just as oil rises to the top of a pot submerged in water, your virtue, your goodness, your faith, or generosity will rise to the top, and that is what will carry you to your next destination." Practicing the good heart, or bodhicitta, is the essence of a good life and the best possible habit. Bodhicitta, which is a heart filled with love and compassion, is also the essence of a Buddha. It purifies negative karma and accumulates positive karma. Lama Zopa Rinpoche says, "The main thing is to practice bodhicitta. Dying with bodhicitta is the best way to die. Try to get to the point where your emotional default is into bodhicitta. In other words, what is your automatic reflex to life situations, especially difficult ones? Do you think about yourself and how you might profit or escape from a situation? Or do you think about others and how you can help? Progress on the path, and a sign that you're well prepared for death, is when the former changes into the latter, when you default not into selfishness, but into selflessness. If you're uncertain about what to do in a situation, just open your heart and love. This is training in bodhicitta. Being a good person and helping others creates the momentum that will carry you gracefully through the bardos. This is important because most of the practices we will discuss are meditations that non-Buddhists would never encounter. Buddhists aren't the only ones who can have a good death or prepare properly. Anyone who lives with genuine goodness will be taken care of by the force of that goodness. Tenga Rinpoche says, "Even though it may appear to be a worldly activity, if you have the attitude of bodhicitta, then it is the practice of dharma, and it will prepare you for death. Bodhicitta lays down a red carpet for you in the bardos." The Dalai Lama says, "While I live, I shall meditate on bodhicitta. This is what gives meaning to my life. At the moment of death, I will meditate on bodhicitta. It will help me continue on my way to enlightenment." His Holiness continues, "If one cultivates spiritual qualities such as mental harmony, humility, non-attachment, patience, love, compassion, wisdom, and so forth, then one becomes equipped with a strength and intelligence able to deal effectively with the problems of this life. And because the wealth one is amassing is mental rather than material, it will not have to be left behind at death. There is no need to enter the after-death state empty-handed." In addition to living a good life, the next task is learning how to let go. If we can cut our attachments, we will live and die with ease. In many ways, the entire spiritual path is about letting go, and is therefore a preparation for death. If we are walking a genuine path, we will be prepared. Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche says, "People say that practicing Dharma is preparation for death, that all Buddhism does is prepare you for death. We are preparing ourselves, very much." We will have a great deal to say about letting go throughout this book. The following practices, many of which are daily meditations, are the most beneficial for death. They are presented in a spectrum going from more common to increasingly esoteric. The point is not that every meditation must be practiced, but to show how much you can do to prepare. These practices also point out how daily meditations are already helping you to prepare. If a practice seems too mystical, don't worry. The esoteric practices are not necessarily more effective than those done by a beginner, especially if they are done wholeheartedly. As the practices get more advanced, they often get simpler. The most advanced practice for death is simply relaxing into it. What is important is the quality of your practice and your faith in it, not the number of practices. Graham Coleman, the principal editor of the first complete translation of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, writes about the esoteric practices. At the heart of these meditative skills are the sophisticated practices through which the masters of these meditative traditions simulate the process of the dissolution of consciousness at the moment of death. The ultimate source of these teachings is a direct, complete, and sustained experiential understanding of the ultimate nature of mind. Once again, the journey through the bardos is a journey through the mind, so any meditation that allows you to become familiar with your mind will prepare you for death. Newcomers may be intimidated by the wealth of meditations available. All these different practices are mentioned because the bardo experience is challenging. Like any intense trip, things may not always go as planned. If plan A doesn't work during the bardo of dying, we have plan B for the bardo of dharmata, and plan C for the bardo of becoming. With so many meditations at our fingertips, we can pull something out of our emergency kit and turn a bad trip into a good one. The most important thing is to prepare. As Chagdut Tulku Rinpoche said of death, "When you have to go to the bathroom, it's too late to build a latrine." The Dalai Lama summarizes the spirit of our journey in this way. Since death is the state when all the gross levels of energy and consciousness have been dissolved, and only the subtle energies and consciousnesses remain, it is possible for an advanced yogin to meditatively induce a state which is almost identical to the actual experience of death. This can be achieved because it is possible to meditatively bring about the dissolution of the gross levels of energy and consciousness. When such a task is accomplished, the meditator gains an enormous potential to progress definitively in his or her spiritual practice. Normally in our lives, if we know that we are going to be confronted by a difficult or unfamiliar situation, we prepare and train ourselves for such a circumstance in advance, so that when the event actually happens, we are fully prepared. The rehearsal of the processes of death and those of the intermediate state and the emergence into a future existence lies at the very heart of the path in highest yoga tantra. These practices are part of my daily practice also, and because of this, I somehow feel a sense of excitement when I think about the experience of death. Practices and teachings to prepare you for death. Shamatha Meditation. There are two central themes repeated throughout the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the most important guidebook in Tibetan Buddhism. The first theme is "Do not be distracted." This relates to shamatha, which is the ability to rest your mind on whatever is happening. The second, the practice of insight meditation, is discussed later. The stability gained from shamatha enables you to face any experience with confidence. In life, and especially in death, distraction is a big deal. The French philosopher Blaise Pascal wrote, "Distraction is the only thing that consoles us for our miseries, and yet it is itself the greatest of our miseries." Shamatha removes the misery. Shamatha, or calm abiding meditation, is a fundamental form of mindful meditation. Mindfulness is a powerful preparation because it does not disintegrate at death. If we cultivate proficiency in this one practice alone, it will act as a spiritual lifeline that we can hold on to during the bardos, and that will guide us through their perilous straits. One of the best preparations for death is learning to accept it and to be fully present for it. Being fully present is the essence of mindfulness, which is developed through shamatha. Because death isn't comfortable, it's difficult to be with. As Woody Allen said, "I'm not afraid of death, I just don't want to be there when it happens." Most of us aren't there for our deaths, and therefore make it more difficult. To get a feel for this, recall how hard it is to be fully present when you're sick. Most of us just want out. Even for an advanced practitioner, it can hurt when the life force separates from the body. Resistance to this hurt, to death, or to any unwanted event, is what creates suffering. We can prepare to embrace the discomfort of death by embracing every moment with mindfulness now. Replace opposition with equanimity. As Dzogchen Ponlop Rinpoche says, "When we are a dying person, we should be a dying person fully. Don't try to be a living person when living is not what's happening." Mindfulness is initially cultivated by practicing shamatha with form, or referential shamatha. This type of shamatha uses the reference of the body, breath, or an object to steady the mind. The idea is to use a stable form while we still have one as a way to stabilize the mind. When physical stability disappears at death, mental stability becomes our primary refuge. When we die, the anchor of the body is cut away and the mind is set free. If we're not prepared for this freedom, we may panic. Imagine being tossed out of a rocket into outer space. The ensuing freakout impels us to grasp at anything that can reestablish a sense of ground. Like catching ourselves just before taking a bad spill on a patch of ice, we reflexively reach out to grab onto anything that keeps us from falling. This grasping reflex can spur us to take on an unfortunate form, and therefore an unfortunate rebirth. The fruition of shamatha is the ability to rest your mind on any object for as long as you wish, and to do so without distraction. Wherever you plop your awareness, it stays there, like a beanbag hitting the ground. Shamatha with form develops into formless shamatha. This is the ability to rest your mind on whatever arises, not just a specified form. You take off the training wheels and ride smoothly on top of anything. Formless or non-referential shamatha is important because when the body drops away at death, we no longer have any stable forms upon which to place our mindfulness. There's nothing steady to refer to. At this groundless point, instead of mentally thrashing about trying to find a form to grasp, formless shamatha allows us to rest on any experience without being swept away. It's not a problem if we don't have a body to come back to. We simply place our mind on whatever is happening and gain stability from that. The reverse meditations and insomnia yoga, discussed later, are helpful in developing this proficiency. Formless shamatha is a lifesaver that keeps us from drowning in a bewildering ocean of experience. The simplicity of mindfulness belies its profundity. It is the gateway to immortality. The philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein said, "If by eternity is understood not endless temporal duration but timelessness, then he lives eternally who lives in the present." Trungpa Rinpoche and Padmasambhava agree. They taught about the four ways to relate to the experience of time, emphasizing the fourth moment. The first three moments relate to the conventional experiences of past, present, and future. The fourth moment is timeless, and therefore immortal. It's beyond the first three. The fourth moment is the immediate experience of the bardo of dharmata, which, we will see, transcends time and space. We don't have to die to experience the deathless dharmata. It lies quietly between each thought, not just between each life. Even though it transcends the first three moments, the only way to enter the fourth moment is through the inlet of the present. Nowness, in other words, is the funnel into eternity. B.K.S. Iyengar, the modern yoga master, says, "The yogi learns to forget the past and takes no thought for the morrow. He lives in the eternal present." If you can't see this in the gap between your thoughts, you can get a feel for it when you're immersed in an activity. If you're 100% present, whether it's playing with your kids, being at a great concert, or engrossed in work, time seems to stand still. You may come out of such an experience, look at the clock, and be startled by how much time has flown by. This is a concordant experience of the fourth moment, the entry into the realm where time, and therefore you, disappears. These magical states, akin to what psychologists call the state of flow, and athletes refer to as the zone, don't have to be accidental. The zone of the fourth moment can be cultivated by training the mind to be present. In this regard, as Zen teacher Baker Roshi puts it, mindfulness makes you accident-prone. The more you practice mindfulness, the more you stumble into the zone. Those who achieve shamatha can rest their minds in meditative absorption, or samadhi, and taste immortality. They have tripped into the deathless zone of total presence. Despite the complexity of the bardos, the meditations which prepare us for them don't need to be complex. Simplicity and relaxation are two key instructions for the bardos. Don't underestimate the power of mindfulness. The Indian master Naropa said, "Since the consciousness, in the bardo, has no support, it is difficult to stabilize mindful intention. But if one can maintain mindfulness, traversing the path will be trouble-free. Meditating for one session in that intermediate state may be liberating." Vipassana meditation. The second main theme in the Tibetan Book of the Dead is that recognition and liberation are simultaneous. This relates to vipassana, the practice of insight meditation. Shamatha pacifies the mind. Vipassana allows us to see it. By seeing our mind more clearly, we're able to recognize how it works. This helps us relate to it skillfully. In the bardos, we're forced to relate to our mind simply because there's nothing else. Outer world is gone, body is gone, so mind becomes reality. Through insight meditation, we discover that whatever arises in the bardos is just the display of our mind. That recognition sets us free. Just as recognizing that we're dreaming while still in a dream, lucid dreaming, frees us from the suffering of the dream, recognizing that we're in the bardos frees us from the suffering of the bardos. Before we became lucid, the dream tossed us to and fro like styrofoam bobbing on turbulent waters. But once we wake up to the dream, while still being in it, the tables are suddenly turned. We now have complete control over an experience that just controlled us. Whether in dream or death, this level of recognition and ensuing liberation is cultivated with vipassana, or clear seeing. Instead of taking the terrifying visions of the bardo to be real and getting caught in the resulting nightmare, we can wake up in the bardos. We do this by recognizing all the appearances to be the display of our own mind. This recognition is exercised in meditation. The meditation instruction is to label whatever distracts us as thinking. For example, a thought pops up of needing to buy some milk. We mentally say, "thinking," which is recognizing that we have strayed, and then return to our meditation. Our clear seeing melts the distracting thought on contact. Labeling and liberation are simultaneous. Unrecognized thought is the daytime equivalent of falling asleep. Each discursive thought is a mini daydream. Drifting off into mindless thinking is how we end up sleepwalking through life, and therefore, death. Saying, "thinking," in our meditation is therefore the same as saying, "wake up." We wake up and come back to reality, not to our dreamy visions, thoughts, about it. If we can wake up during the day and be mindful, we will be able to wake up in the bardo after we die. This is what it means to become a Buddha, an awakened one. And this is the fruition of shamatha vipassana. Earlier we said that in the bardos, mind, thought, becomes reality. What do you come back to if there is only mind? You come back to just that recognition. As in a lucid dream, you realize that whatever arises is merely the play of your mind. This allows you to witness whatever appears without being carried away by it. Since you no longer have a body, or any other material object to take refuge in, you take refuge in recognition, awareness, itself. From that awakened perspective, it doesn't matter what happens. It's all just a display of the mind. The Four Reminders. The four reminders, or four thoughts that turn the mind, are an important preparation for death because they turn the mind from constantly looking outward to finally looking within. As with mindfulness, they provide another way to work with distraction. They bring the key instruction, do not be distracted, to a more comprehensive level. The four reminders show us that it's not just momentary distraction that's problematic, but distraction at the level of an entire life. If we're not reminded, we can be mindless and waste our whole life. Trungpa Rinpoche presented them this way. 1. Contemplate the preciousness of being so free and well-favored. This is difficult to gain, easy to lose, now I must do something meaningful. 2. The whole world and its inhabitants are impermanent. In particular, the life of beings is like a bubble. Death comes without warning. This body will be a corpse. At that time, the Dharma will be my only help. I must practice it with exertion. 3. When death comes, I will be helpless. Because I create karma, I must abandon evil deeds and always devote myself to virtuous actions. Thinking this, every day I will examine myself. 4. The homes, friends, wealth, and comforts of samsara are the constant torment of the three sufferings. Just like a feast before the executioner leads you to your death, I must cut desire and attachment and attain enlightenment through exertion. How long should we contemplate these reminders? Until our mind turns, until we give up hope for samsara and realize the folly of finding happiness outside. Most of us spend our lives looking out at the world, chasing after thoughts and things. We're distracted by all kinds of objects and rarely look into the mind, which is the ultimate source of these objects. If we turn our mind and look in the right direction, however, we will find our way to a good life and a good death. Instead of being carried along with the external constructs of mind, we finally examine the internal blueprints of mind itself. It is often said that the preliminaries are more important than the main practice. The significance of these four reminders as a preliminary practice cannot be overstated. Chökyi Nyima Rinpoche said that if we could truly take them to heart, 50% of the path to enlightenment would be complete. These contemplations develop revulsion to conditioned appearances, point out their utter futility, and cause awareness to prefer itself rather than outwardly appearing objects. They turn the mind away from substitute gratifications and direct it toward authentic gratification, which can only be found within. The four thoughts remind us of the preciousness of this human life, that we are going to die, that karma follows us everywhere, and that samsara is a waste of time that only supplies suffering. Memorize them. They will reframe your life, focus your mind, and advise you in everything you do. As Samuel Johnson, the author of the first English dictionary, said, "When a man knows he is to be hanged in a fortnight, it concentrates his mind wonderfully." What would you do if you had 6 months to live? What would you cut out of your life? What would you do if you had 1 month, 1 week, 1 day? The Indian master Atisha said, "If you do not contemplate death in the morning is wasted. If you do not contemplate death in the afternoon is wasted. If you do not contemplate death in the evening is wasted." The four reminders remove the waste. One of the best ways to prepare for death is to acknowledge that we really are going to die. We are falling in the dark and have no idea when we will hit the ground. Buddhist scholar Anne Klein says, "Life is a party on death row. Recognizing mortality means we are willing to see what is true. Seeing what is true is grounding. It brings us into the present. We all know that we're going to die. But we don't know it in our guts. If we did, we would practice as if our hair was on fire." Trungpa Rinpoche said that until we take death to heart, our spiritual practice is dilettantish. Author Sam Harris wrote, "While we try not to think about it, nearly the only thing we can be certain of in this life is that we will one day die and leave everything behind. And yet, paradoxically, it seems almost impossible to believe that this is so. Our felt sense of what is real seems not to include our own death. We doubt the one thing that is not open to any doubt at all. We see others dying all around us, but somehow feel entitled to an exemption." In the Hindu epic, the Mahabharata, the sage Yudhishthir is asked, "Of all things in life, what is the most amazing?" Yudhishthir answers, "That a man, seeing others die all around him, never thinks he will die." If we acknowledge death and use it as an advisor, however, it will prioritize our life, ignite our renunciation, and spur our meditation. The Buddha said, "Of all footprints, that of the elephant is the deepest and most supreme. Of all contemplations, that of impermanence is the deepest and most supreme. He who dies with the most toys still dies." Bring these supreme reminders into your life. Realize that life is like a candle flame in the wind. Visualize friends and family and say, "Uncle Joe is going to die. My sister Sarah is going to die. My friend Bill is going to die. I am going to die." Put pictures of dead loved ones on your desk or shrine. Put sticky notes with the word death or "I am going to die" inside drawers or cabinets to remind you. Read an obituary every day. Go to nursing homes, cemeteries, and funerals. The essence of spiritual practice is remembrance, whether it's remembering to come back to the present moment or recalling the truth of impermanence. Do whatever it takes to realize that time is running out and you really could die today. You are literally one breath away from death. Breathe out, don't breathe in, and you're dead. One of the marks of an advanced student is that they finally realize that today could be the day. As Paul Simon sang, "I'll continue and continue to pretend that my life will never end." We essentially spend our lives moving desk chairs around the Titanic. No matter how we position ourselves, how comfortable we try to get, it's all going down. These teachings exhort us not to spend our lives, which most of us do literally and figuratively. Reinvest. Take the precious opportunity that has been given to you, and do not waste your life. The four thoughts that turn the mind turn it from reckless spending to wise investing. Invest in your future lives now. On a personal note, this has been the greatest gift in my study and practice of the Bardos. I'm thick-headed, but I finally get it. I am going to die, and it could be today. My life has been completely restructured because I now believe it. These reminders may seem like a morbid preoccupation with death, but only because of our extreme aversion to dying. For most of us, death is the final defeat. Historian Arnold Toynbee said, "Death is un-American." Jack LaLanne, the fitness and diet guru, once said, "I can't afford to die. It would wreck my image." We live in denial of death and suffer in direct proportion to this denial when death occurs. The four reminders remind us of the uncompromising truth of reality and prepare us to face it. Lama Zopa Rinpoche writes, "The very last thing the Buddha left, his very last teaching, like a will that ordinary people leave that talks of worldly things, the most precious things to the ordinary person, the most important and beneficial thing that Shakyamuni Buddha could bequeath, the most important thing for us to realize and understand is the truth and reality of impermanence." His entire teaching career ended with this. This one word, impermanence, captures the full range of samsaric suffering. The four reminders, joined with shamatha, instill a strength of mind that benefits both self and other. The Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche taught, "The strength of shamatha is that our mind is slow enough and stable enough to bring in the reality, to really see it. Then when someone we know is dying, we aren't so shaken up. We may be sad in the sense of feeling compassion, but we have thoroughly incorporated the notion of death to the point that it has profoundly affected our life. That is known as strength of mind. That stability naturally radiates to stabilize the mind of the dying person, which helps them when everything is being blown away. Dying people are sometimes jealous of those still alive. Why do I have to die when everyone else keeps on living? It's so unfair. Why me? At that point, they need to remember that those left behind are not returning to a party that lasts till infinity. Those left behind are returning to a challenging life that is filled with the three kinds of suffering. As you are dying, remember that it's just a matter of time before everyone else joins you, just as you are about to join the billions of others who have already left this life for another one. Those left behind are a minority. No one is going to get out of this alive." Doctrinal preparation. One of the best preparations for the bardos is learning about them. Study the map and you will recognize the territory. Studying the bardos is like installing a psychic GPS. After death, you will know where you are and what you need to do. Learning about the bardos establishes the proper view. This view allows you to see your way through the darkness of death and to eliminate fear. It also inspires you to do the meditation that prepares you for death, to go beyond understanding into direct experience, the confidence born from view and meditation that leads to the fruition of action. With a stable mind cultivated by view and meditation, we can benefit ourselves and others because now we know what to do. This trilogy of view, meditation, and action is a central teaching for how to progress along the spiritual path. The Tibetan word for meditation is gom, which means to become familiar with, the central theme of this book. Meditation is about becoming familiar with every aspect of your mind. This is important because, as we have seen, the journey through the bardos is really a journey of the mind. It is a journey through the mind, through both its wisdom and confusion. Learning to face death is therefore learning how to face ourselves. By becoming familiar with the bardos through study, we're becoming familiar with our mind, and by becoming familiar with our mind through meditation, we're becoming familiar with the bardos. Death is never the enemy. Ignorance and unfamiliarity are the only enemies. Practice and study defeat this enemy. As we will see in the following, the confused aspects of our mind die during the bardo of dying, the wisdom aspects are revealed during the bardo of dharmata, and the confused aspects are reborn in the bardo of becoming. This is why people experience the bardos differently, and this is why we should never let any map, no matter how sophisticated, constrict the experience of the territory. When the mind is liberated from the body, it is 7 to 9 times clearer. This opaque statement in the bardo literature is clarified by Trangu Rinpoche's comments. It suggests that instructions heard now can be recalled after death. Trangu Rinpoche says, "Having heard these bardo instructions will have placed a certain habit or imprint in your mind, and you will recall this imprint when you reach that phase of the bardo. For example, when you find yourself in the bardo of becoming, you will notice what is happening, and you will think, 'Oh, wait a second, I have heard about this. Let's see, I'm supposed to do such and such when such and such happens.' And that will obviously benefit you tremendously. Bardo instructions are particularly helpful to you at that time when you are in the most danger and are undergoing the most stress and terror. In other words, when you need them the most. You may not feel that you'll be able to remember these instructions in the bardo and resign yourself to a difficult journey, but Rinpoche continues, 'Since you have no corporeal body, your mind is the most powerful thing in your experience. Therefore, virtuous states of mind and states of meditative absorption and so on have much more power in the bardo than in our ordinary lives. All of these types of meditation will have much more power and be much clearer in the bardo.'" Fear is always associated with the unknown and the unfamiliar. Fear and ignorance are virtually synonymous. Through our study and practice, we remove the darkness of ignorance that surrounds death and transform fear into fearlessness. This is the job of Manjushri, the deity of wisdom. His wrathful manifestation is called Yamantaka, the destroyer of Yama. Yama is the embodiment of death. So Yamantaka, uncompromising and almost wrathful wisdom, is how we can conquer death. In other words, we conquer and transform death by becoming familiar with it. One of the reasons it's difficult to leave this world is because we're so familiar with it. It's all we know. Even though it's samsara, we feel snug and secure in its ways, and these ways are hard to abandon. Conversely, one of the reasons it's difficult to enter the next world is because it's so unfamiliar. We don't know it at all. Even though it presents great opportunities for enlightenment, we're afraid to step into the unknown. So too much familiarity with this world and not enough with the next is what makes this transition difficult. In other words, too much familiarity with our superficial confusion and not enough familiarity with our innate wisdom, both of which are revealed in the bardos, is the basis for a rough journey after death. We will return to this important theme throughout the book because this lack of familiarity is what shoots us out of the bardo of dharmata and into the bardo of becoming, and therefore back into samsara. It's the basis of reincarnation. Do we choose wisdom, which is brilliant and unfamiliar, and wake up? Or confusion, which is cozy and familiar, and fall back asleep? Learning about the bardos is also more than just learning about death. They are a condensation of the entire path. This means that a concordant experience of the bardos occurs in a microcosmic form every night when we die into sleep and are reborn the next morning. It also occurs between the birth and death of every thought. Studying the bardos helps us not only to have a good death, but to lead a good life. This is another theme we will return to frequently. Tonglen. Tonglen, sending and talking, which is the practice of taking in the suffering of others and giving out the goodness within ourselves, is a strong preparation for death. It is especially powerful for a dying person to practice and for others to do when someone has died. The rugged quality of this practice can match the toughness of death. The more I'm around death, the more I find myself taking refuge in Tonglen. The reason we suffer during life or death is because we are selfish. When we think small, every little irritation gets big. Conversely, when we think big, difficulties get small. Tonglen is about thinking and feeling big. To think big, we should first reflect upon our good fortune. We have the precious Dharma to guide us through the bardos, and we have the potential to transform death into enlightenment. We are incredibly fortunate to die held by the teachings of the Buddha, the awakened one who transcended death. Now think about the millions who are dying without being held. Imagine all those who are dying alone, without physical or spiritual refuge, or under violent conditions. We can reduce our anguish by putting our death in perspective. Tonglen instills that perspective and brings greater meaning to our death. If you take a teaspoon of salt and put it into a shot glass of water, the water is powerfully affected. It gets super salty. If you take the same amount of salt and put it into Lake Michigan, it has virtually no effect. Tonglen transforms our mind from a shot glass into Lake Michigan. On every level, suffering is the result of the mind's inability to accommodate its experience. Lama Zopa Rinpoche says, "Try to die with this motivation. If you die with this bodhicitta thought, your death becomes a cause of your enlightenment and a cause for the enlightenment of all sentient beings. Live your life with this precious thought. As you get closer to death, you should think, I am experiencing death on behalf of all sentient beings. Try to die with this thought. In this way, you are dying for others. Dying with the thought of others is the best way to die." The Indian sage Shantideva said, "If you want to be miserable, think only of yourself. If you want to be happy, even in death, think only of others. Tonglen is therefore a way to practice the good heart of bodhicitta. When asked what practice he would do during death, Trungpa Rinpoche once replied, "Tonglen." Reverse meditations. Tonglen is part of a family of practices we could call reverse meditations. They are called reverse because with these practices we do things that are the opposite of what we usually associate with meditation. Reverse meditations expand our sense of meditation and prepare us for death. They are based on this tenet. If you can bring unwanted experience into the sanctuary of sanity provided by meditation, you can transform that obstacle into opportunity. This approach applies to life and especially to death. If you can bring death into the path, you can flip it into enlightenment. The most unwanted experience transforms into the most coveted experience. Tonglen is a classic reverse meditation because it takes in the darkness of others and sends out our light. This is the reverse of how ego operates. Pain meditation is a reverse meditation that prepares us for the painful bardo of dying. In addition to the emotional pain of letting go, there is often physical pain associated with disease. To prepare for this pain, we voluntarily bring it into our experience now, on our terms. Reverse meditations are done within the context of shamatha meditation. This provides the crucible for establishing a proper relationship to the unwanted experience. For the pain meditation, after doing shamatha for a few minutes, you can bite your lip or tongue or dig your fingernail into your thumb and explore the sensation. Go into the pain. What is pain? What is it made of? What happens if I dissolve into it? Reverse meditations are not pleasant, but neither is death. Do them for short sessions and remember that masochism is not the point. While the pain may not disappear, the suffering does. Pain meditation helps us erase what Trungpa Rinpoche called negative negativity, which is the resistance to the pain. Negative negativity is like being shot with two arrows. The first arrow hurts you physically. If you can stay with that pain and relate to it directly, it will still hurt, but not as much as when you bring in your storylines. The second arrow is the mental commentary that transforms simple pain into complex suffering. By becoming one with the pain, there is no one to hurt, and the character of the pain changes. This practice radically alters our relationship to discomfort. It reverses it. The next time you get a headache, turn that pain into meditation. Watch the pain transform before your eyes. Reverse meditations require diligence. We would rather sit in tranquility than plunge into pain. But to establish a healthy relationship to unwanted experiences, we have to spend time with them. It's always easier to do so on our own terms. We may think we'll be able to relate to pain or death just by having read about it, but that attitude is seldom realized when we actually hurt or die. Dzogchen Ponlop Rinpoche says, "It is very difficult to transform an experience of intense suffering if we have no basis for working with pain to begin with. Therefore, it is initially necessary to work with minor pains and illness and discover how we can bring these to the path. Then, as more severe sicknesses come to us, we are able to bring those to the path as well. Eventually, we become capable of bringing even the most debilitating conditions to the path. If you become accustomed to looking at the experience of pain, if that looking is genuine and you can rest your mind in the pure sensation, then you will see a difference in how you experience the pain. When a greater sickness strikes us, we will not be hit by it in the same way. It will not be such a problem or a shock. We can face even the pain and suffering of dying with greater confidence because we are facing familiar territory instead of the unknown. When the actual moment of death arrives, we will be able to look at that pain and transform it. Having done this pain meditation for years, I now relate very differently to the sting of an insect bite or a stubbed toe. Instead of my knee-jerk aversion to pain, it almost becomes spiritual. My throbbing toe reminds me to meditate, which alters the intensity of the pain. I'm beginning to bring pain onto my path." Another reverse meditation is to create as many thoughts as possible. Instead of calming your mind down, whip it up. Again, start with shamatha, then make your mind as stormy as possible. Think of yesterday, think of tomorrow, visualize Paris, New York, or the pyramids. Do so as quickly as you can. Now is your chance to do what you always wanted to do on the meditation cushion. Go hog wild mentally. This is particularly helpful for the karmic bardo of becoming, where the gales of karma re-arise and blow us into our next life. By becoming familiar with those winds now, we'll be able to sail in stormy seas later. Notice that you can sit quietly in the center of this voluntary cyclone and not be moved by it. You're practicing how to hold your seat in the midst of mental chaos. Don't buy into the thoughts and emotions, just watch the upheaval. This practice expands the sense of shamatha because even though your mind is howling, you're able to maintain inner peace. As the sage Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj said, it is disinterestedness that liberates. Do the meditation for a minute. Rest in shamatha, then do it again. Because reverse meditations are intense, short sessions prevent resentment. Don't underestimate the power of short meditations. Ponlop Rinpoche says, we usually view anything small as unimportant and not really worth doing. For example, if we only have 5 minutes to meditate, we tell ourselves, oh, 5 minutes is nothing. It is not enough to change my life. I need to practice for at least an hour. But with meditation, short is sweet. It's like running. You don't start with a marathon. You start with short runs and work your way up. Short sessions repeated frequently are just as effective, if not more so, as longer sessions done infrequently. And when it comes to mixing meditation and post-meditation, which is how to transform your life into meditation, short frequent sessions reign supreme. Another meditation is to place yourself in a loud and overly stimulating environment, then work with staying centered. Flip on the television, crank up the stereo, turn on the alarm clock, and sit with the cacophony. Go to a loud and crazy place and meditate. If you have kids, this environment is part of your life. One of Tulku Urgen Rinpoche's sons once complained to him about how hard it is to meditate in Kathmandu, Nepal, because of all the noise and distraction. Rinpoche said to him, if you can't practice under these conditions, how will you ever practice in the bardo? As with all reverse meditations, find the silence in the noise, the stillness in the motion. Even if you never do these meditations, just knowing about them helps you reverse your relationship to unwanted experience. The next time you're in a crazy environment, like a subway station or Times Square, you might remember these instructions and transform the mayhem into meditation. I frequently travel to India, a land of intense chaos. Instead of getting irritated when the flies, heat, noise, beggars, and pollution assault me, I try to relax into the pandemonium. I reverse my usual defensive approach to these unpleasant situations and bring them onto my path. There are times when I just can't do it and run away. But even then, I remember the spirit of these strange meditations and try to convert my automatic aversion. All the reverse meditations culminate in equanimity, which is the ability to relate to whatever arises without bias. At the highest stages of the path, one no longer has any preference for chaos or calm, samsara or nirvana. Everything is experienced evenly. Pleasant experiences are not cultivated, unpleasant ones are not shunned. As we have seen, distraction is one of the biggest problems in life and death. Therefore, one of the most important instructions is, do not be distracted. The reverse meditations are a formidable way to end distraction because they bring distraction onto the path. They show us how to reverse our relationship to distraction. Instead of feeling that our meditation is constantly being interrupted by a thought, a noise, or even life itself, the reverse meditations bring these interruptions into our practice. They become our practice. Kenpo Sultrim Gyamso Rinpoche said that if you're in retreat and hear a noise that makes you angry, it's a sign that you're unable to bring distraction onto your path. Since fear is common in the bardos, Kenpo Rinpoche recommends watching horror movies as a way to work with it. This is a potent reverse meditation for all the bardos, but especially for the bardo of becoming. Because we don't recognize the appearances of this bardo to be projections of our mind, the farther we go into it, the more terrifying it becomes. The fear becomes so piercing that it can force us to grasp an unfortunate rebirth just to escape the intensity of our own mind. Establishing a relationship to fear now helps us relate to it then and can prevent such a birth. I find this reverse meditation really challenging. The films are wretched, violent, and extremely difficult to watch. I usually have to look away or pause the movie to bring any sense of meditation to it. My normal response is tremendous revulsion. But as contrived and almost silly as this practice appears, it does evoke a host of nasty feelings. It allows me to become familiar with the shadowy side of my being, a dark side that comes to light in the bardo of becoming. Horror movies give me the opportunity to befriend horrible feelings I would otherwise never encounter. A key instruction in life or death is to join whatever we experience with meditation. But without actually practicing this, it's hard to do. An unwanted experience arises, habitual patterns immediately kick in, and we run from the experience or relate to it poorly. The reverse meditations allow us to replace these bad habits with good ones. When difficult situations arise, wisdom kicks in instead of confusion. Pure Land Practice. Several years ago, I asked Trangu Rinpoche, who has taught extensively on the bardos, this question. If a Buddhist realized they only had a year left to live, what practice should they emphasize? He replied, pure land practice. His answer may surprise students of Tibetan Buddhism, where pure lands are rarely mentioned. Kenpo Kalta Rinpoche says that as death approaches, the main deity we should relate to is Amitabha, the principal pure land Buddha. Pure land practice is important because if you don't attain enlightenment in the bardos, the next best thing is to gain rebirth into a pure land. There are a number of reasons for doing this. First, pure land rebirths, while not yet nirvana, are outside of samsara. They're free from the aging, sickness, and death of samsaric existence. There is no overt suffering. Second, they are non-retrogressive. Once you're born into a pure land, you'll never fall back to samsara, unless you do so voluntarily. Third, spiritual progress is rapid in a pure land. It's like being born into a country where everyone is a lama and everybody practices the dharma. The developmental center of gravity is so high that you have no choice but to evolve. Fourth, this spiritual progress allows you to develop powers of supercognition. With these abilities, you're more effective in helping others. Going to a pure land is not getting out of your bodhisattva vow to benefit all beings. It is fulfilling it more rapidly. It's like going to graduate school instead of staying back in kindergarten. Fifth, birth into a pure land is your last rebirth before attaining enlightenment. The most famous pure land, and the one at the heart of the pure land tradition, is Sukhavati, the land of bliss. Sukhavati is generally regarded as the only pure land where ordinary beings like ourselves can be reborn. Almost all the other pure lands require the attainment of the first bhumi, which is a lofty level of realization. The Tibetan tradition, whose approach to the pure lands differs from traditional Korean, Chinese, or Japanese pure land practice, is centered on a tenet that we will return to frequently. The mind leads all things. By cultivating pure states of mind in this life, that will lead us to a pure land after death. Kalu Rinpoche says, by the orientation given to our mind in this life, once in the bardo, we become conscious that we are dead, and we see Amitabha coming to welcome us. We will recognize him and wish for rebirth in his pure land. This thought is enough to make us go there immediately. Four principal meditations cultivate the conditions necessary for rebirth in Sukhavati. The first is to contemplate the details of Buddha Amitabha, the Buddha who created this pure land for us, and of Sukhavati itself. This is done by studying the descriptions found in the longer Sukhavati Sutra, or the progressive visualizations of the Meditation Sutra. At the moment of death, mindscape becomes landscape. Second, accumulate merit. Even though the transfer of merit from Amitabha is a principal force in our rebirth in Sukhavati, we need our own merit. Third, develop the mind of enlightenment and bodhicitta. Tulku Tondop says, "You must vow or be determined to lead all mother beings, without exception, to the blissful pure land without any selfishness, and you must put that aspiration into practice through meditation and beneficial deeds." Fourth, dedicate the merit you have gathered for rebirth in Sukhavati and make heartfelt aspirations to be reborn there. Ascertain that you are dedicating merit exactly as your forefathers did on their path to enlightenment. These dedications and aspirations are like a steering wheel that guides our merit toward the goal of rebirth in Sukhavati. All four causes are based on faith in Amitabha and his pure land. This is the most important factor for entry into Sukhavati. We have to really believe in this pure land and in the power of Amitabha to help us at the moment of death. These four factors are encapsulated in the famous Sukhavati aspiration prayer by Karma Chagme Rinpoche. There are Amitabha meditations and many other aspiration prayers, but this is the most widely practiced liturgy for Tibetan Buddhists. Tulku Nyima Rinpoche describes an Amitabha practice to do every night. As you lie down to sleep, visualize Amitabha on top of your head. Recite his mantra, Om Amideva Hri, 3 times. Dissolve the visualization of Amitabha into your heart. Feel his bliss and light. Then go to sleep with Amitabha tucked into your heart and mind. Vajrayana students practice an esoteric form of Pure Land Buddhism with meditations on sacred outlook or pure perception. This is the pure land of the present moment, as Thich Nhat Hanh refers to it, particularly the fourth moment we discussed earlier. Sacred outlook is an important preparation for the bardos because a key instruction, while in the bardo, is to see everything as perfectly pure. This shifts our relationship to whatever arises. It erases our tendency to poison experience with passion, aggression, or ignorance. These three root poisons are the spark plugs that drive the engine of samsara. I want it, passion. I don't want it, aggression. I couldn't care less, ignorance. They define our existence. The three poisons transform an inherently pure world into the impure land of daily life. In the bardo, this impure perception hurls us into an impure birth. Because Vajrayana, esoteric Buddhism, emphasizes pure mind, it's easy to dismiss the exoteric schools and their emphasis on pure land. Many people dismiss the pure land tradition as easy or lazy Buddhism. They denigrate it as being for those who can't handle the rigors of real Buddhism. Some writers say the pure lands are for beginners. For others, it sounds theistic. Amitabha sounds like God and Sukhavati sounds like heaven. But the Buddha taught on Sukhavati, and some of the greatest masters in Tibetan Buddhism wrote extensively about it. They spurred their disciples to engage in the practice to get there. Even though there is no Pure Land sect in Tibetan Buddhism, there is a strong Pure Land orientation. It's also tempting to regard Sukhavati as merely symbolic, but Sukhavati is just as real or unreal as this earth. It's a place created by the merit of Amitabha for people like us. We should take it seriously. For most of us, going to Sukhavati is the best thing we can do after we die. Preparation for sudden death. We may have our vision of a perfect death, but life doesn't always cooperate. 1 out of 10 people will die suddenly and unexpectedly. What should we do if we're about to die in an accident? The instruction is simple. Bring your awareness to the top of your head and recite the mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. Bringing awareness to the top of your head is a form of emergency powa, discussed later. Reciting the mantra of Chenrezig, the bodhisattva of compassion, closes the doors to the 6 realms of samsara. It also invokes his blessing. If compassion has a sound, it is Om Mani Padme Hum. By bringing your awareness to the top of your head, you open the door to rebirth in the pure realms. This can be done by visualizing your guru or a deity directly above you, or by merely turning your gaze upward. If you panic and can't remember what to do, then cry out to your teacher or a spiritual being for help. Instead of having "oh shit" on your mind when you're about to die, it's better to have your teacher or Amitabh on your mind, and to be reborn in his pure land. The way to practice for sudden death is to recite the mantra, or visualize the deity, whenever you receive sudden bad news or are somehow shocked. Any experience that throws you into a feeling of groundlessness is an opportunity to practice for sudden death. It's like appending "bless you" after someone sneezes. For most people, this polite habit is automatic, but it didn't happen automatically. You had to practice it. When your lover tells you he or she is leaving you, have the presence of mind to say to yourself, Om Mani Padme Hum. Or a friend just died, Om Mani Padme Hum. You just got fired, Om Mani Padme Hum. Small sudden deaths happen all the time and give us opportunities to practice for the big one. I started practicing this whenever I read about a violent death in the paper or heard about it on the news. A suicide bomber blew up 20 people. Om Mani Padme Hum. A teenager was killed in a car accident. Om Mani Padme Hum. A tornado destroyed an entire town. Om Mani Padme Hum. My usual response had been to close down around such news. It was too painful. But this "bless you" mantra showed me how to keep my heart open and to connect to the suffering of others. After a few weeks of mindful effort, this good habit took root. With this preliminary practice directed to others, I was then able to extend it to my own daily deaths. If you're trained in Powa, then the instructions for sudden death may vary depending on your training. But the essential practice is simple, which is what we need in a time of crisis. Gauge your readiness for sudden death by looking at how you react to critical situations. When you wake up sweating from a nightmare, do you respond with practice or don't you? When a car cuts you off and almost sends you into the ditch, what happens to your mind? Use any heart-pounding situation both to assess your readiness and to practice for any heart-stopping accidents.